Thank you, multi-talented guest announcer Ian Punnett, who will be coming your way in just under an hour from now on Coast to Coast AM as he fills in for Art Bell. His guest tonight, Doreen Virtue, who will be talking about the mer people, the aquatic ape theory, and indigo children. So catch that and find out what that is all about just under an hour from now on Premier Radio Networks. Our guest this hour, as he has been for the last couple of hours, Neil Slade, author of books on brain and behavior science. Matter of fact, authored 5 books, The Frontal Lobe Supercharge, his primary book, Brain Magic, Have Fun, Anti-Rules for Life, Cosmic Conversations, and Self-Transcendence Workbook. He's got 20 brain music and audio CDs and a feature film to his credit, a feature film DVD, An Amazing Brain Adventure, which runs, about 5 hours? Got a lot of documentary stuff and has been aired on some PBS stations, I believe, certainly in the Denver area. Right, Neil?
That's correct.
All right. Now, we were talking about the nose earlier and its connection to the amygdala, and it has been said that the nose is kind of like brain radar, which fits right in with your website, brainradar.com. If you'd like to order any of Neil's books or CDs, you can do that at www.brainradar.com, I believe.
That's right. Well, you exactly right, that the nose is very primitive frontal lobes types of processes. It allows us to see in advance, and for animals, it was like, you know, if you were a fox, you could smell the grizzly bear that was on the other side of the hill, or you could see what threats, let's say an animal goes up to a piece of food, and the odors emanating from that food would tell that animal whether the food was safe to eat or not safe to eat. By
as we can generally do from time, you know, something you get an immediate rancid response. Oh boy, that's gone bad.
Well, that's a really good way, and we call it, there's an exercise that I show people called the nose knows, and you can read about that on the website, or I'll just tell people right now how to do that. And this is a way of, you know, people always want to know, how do I know if my amygdala is clicking forward and backward? Well, the easiest way is to monitor your emotions. If you are experiencing negative emotions, that almost always tells you that you are computing reptilian, primitive, reactive brain processes, and you are absent advanced frontal lobes processes. But if you have pleasurable emotional sensations, this is how nature is encouraging you. It's telling you, yes, go this way. Do what is giving you long-term pleasure. Now, the nose, you can use your own nose to kind of tune you into this reality. So what you should do is go into your kitchen, right, and go to your garbage pail and stick your nose down in that garbage pail and take a long, deep breath. And then notice what your emotional content becomes, okay? Now,
I can pretty much tell you generally what my emotional content will be when I do that.
Well, that's your amygdala clicking backwards, okay? It's unpleasant. It gives you a bad feeling, all right? Now, conversely, now go to your food closet and make some popcorn and put some butter on top of that. And then take a really good whiff of that. Ah, that smells really good. Or maybe go out into your garden where you have some fresh roses that are blooming, right, and take a whiff. Ah, now there's a really warm, positive, life-sustaining feeling that you have inside your brain. That's what it feels like when your amygdala is clicked forward. It's as simple as that. And all you have to do is tune in to that feeling, okay, knowing the difference between long-term life-sustaining pleasure and short-term, quickie.
Indeed.
Yeah, get drunk pleasure, right? And
okay,
and that's how you can tell whether your amygdala is clicking forward or clicking backwards.
Amazing, though, that depending on the situation, sometimes alcohol smells great, and other times like, oh my god.
Yeah, I just watched a great program by John Cleese on wine. And
mm-hmm.
they were talking about all the very subtle flavors of wine and what this great, and there's no one thing that makes something good or bad. You can have a knife and you can kill somebody with that knife, but you can also use the knife to cut cheese, right? Or to, you know, do surgery, right? Or to carve a wonderful carving. So it's not so much in the thing, it's how you apply
it. How you use the tool.
Yeah, that's right. So alcohol can be very destructive, but it can also be something that brings someone great pleasure and great, you know, enjoyment of life.
All right. You know, we've had a lot of people been holding for a long time before they get their noses out of joint. Let's go to the phones. A lot of people want to talk to you. Let's go to the wild card line. Gail is calling, I believe, from Santa Barbara. Gail, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Hi, Gail.
Gail.
Gail G.
Gail.
Yeah.
A lot of wine in that part of the country, too, huh?
Yeah. I have a question. I think it's a good one. Okay, I've heard that people who have survived catastrophic events, that the rest of the world says, wow, how could they have survived that? I've heard that they've studied those people, and those people have at one time imagined themselves in a similar or the exact situation and have thought out what they would have done.
That's very interesting. I haven't heard that, but it makes perfect sense with what we were talking about before, whereas the guy who stops at the ranger cabin and reads the instructions what to do in an emergency versus somebody who doesn't even bother to plan ahead or can't anticipate things. You know, you've got to sort of, you know, you've got to imagine all kinds of scenarios. I think one of the major problems we have in society is that often we're afraid to look at events that may appear to be, that may be traumatic. And I know from my work at the Brain Lab for 11 years that if people are going to overcome traumatic events, they've got to face them. And they say the way to make a problem, the way to allow a problem to grow and get worse is to resist it. So very often we have to look at something that is unpleasant, and we have to look at it directly, and we have to approach it with common sense and logic and analysis, and that's how we get through those kinds of things.
Gail, we thank you for your... Go ahead, Gail.
Well, very quick. Part of this question I think is really good, too. If I was raised to not honor or respect my fear emotion, so I'm very cognitive and very bright, and I don't get afraid as most people. And I kind of hated my mom for it, but I think I might want to thank her now.
That you do acknowledge that part of fear in you?
Well, I don't. I really don't have, when I feel fear, I kind of go into my cognitive, the front part of my brain.
Oh, that's right. Exactly. Yes. What you're doing is you're clicking forward through the fear, and you're using your cortex and those advanced intellectual processes to overcome those more primitive reactive. And so that's a demonstration of clicking forward. That's excellent.
Although, Neil, can't that be dangerous, though, when you click forward out of a fearful situation where you really do need that flight response or fight response?
Yeah, I understand. Yes,
I mean, you don't want to click yourself in. You don't want to click yourself into naivete.
Well, yeah, you know, it's sort of like if you take, for example, if you were to take too much of a mind-altering drug, that you might think that Mack truck coming towards you is your mother. You know, you want to
my mother and I will forget that you said that.
Turn off your reptile brain reactions. They're there to help you survive. Okay, fear is a part of you that you don't shut it off. It's the part that allows you to remove your hand from the fire, but at the
right.
same time you can learn to control fire. You can learn to carefully build a log fire in your fireplace.
Right, and once again, we're using not what the tool is, but how you use it, good
that's
or bad.
That's exactly right. So all these reptilian reactions, they are there to help you survive. The point is that you don't allow yourself to be ruled by your primitive reactions, that you allow them their place and that you learn to grow beyond that.
All right, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast Live with Neil Slade.
Hello. Hi.
Hi there.
This
Stephen?
Is Stephen. Hi, Stephen. I'm a friend of your people on your programs. So I always listen to them. But I want to tell you about what you're talking about now. You're delving with nanotechnology. Now, there are practical instruments now that are used, like life force field reactors, north-south, and east-west monopolar functioning devices that are used. Now, in the war on terrorism, the Life Force Field Reactor will immediately identify any person who has diabetes just by pointing the instrument at them.
Well, and certainly good to know which terrorists have diabetes. What do you say to that, Neil?
Well, you know, I mean, I think he's brought up a very valid topic, because we know that one of the tools that you know, all types of medical people and military people are using have to do with brain function, and that nanotechnology is really just a technology that exists on such a small level that things can be,
no pun intended, right?
Yeah, I mean, things can affect a person's mental state of being on a level that we physically can barely get a hold of. And you know,
and then we start delving into artificial intelligence and the blending of the organic with the technical, as we discussed in the first hour of the program tonight.
Sure, technology is advancing to such a level that you know, there are tools and there are even weapons that exist on this microcellular level, and we have to be aware of things like that and how we can be manipulated in directions that we may not want to go by simple things like you know, implants of micro circuitry, for example, and things like that. So it's something to be aware of.
Right, let us go to the first-time caller line, a call that I've been wanting to get to here, because I believe this is an old friend of mine from whom I have not heard probably in 15 years. You're on Coast to Coast Live, Dr. John Lombardi.
Ross, how are you?
Is it you?
It is I. Yes,
it is.
Yes, sure.
How is it that you are, doctor?
Doing very well. And yourself?
We're doing well and having a great time.
You guys are great. And I really like what Dr. Slade's saying. He mentioned a couple of things. I'm a professional criminologist, and I focus on violent crimes and litigation and training and things like that. Got my own company. But you had mentioned music therapy.
Uh-huh.
And it's very interesting that you bring that up, because I use it myself as I go over the cases that I have.
Uh-huh.
And Baroque classical music, which I do not understand, is just wonderful, because it levels you out. If you're too high, it's going to level you. If you're feeling a little depressed, it's going to level you up.
Yeah, hence the expression, go for Baroque.
Absolutely.
Now, do you listen to, now, as I, you know, I studied a little bit this topic called super learning.
Mm-hmm.
And this was developed by, I forget the name of the company that used to teach languages to people.
Sure.
And what they found is that they played the slower movements of Baroque
mm-hmm.
music
sure.
that was paced at about 50 or 60 beats per minute. It actually
mm-hmm.
increased the retention of information multiple times. And it allowed the person who is learning to pace themselves,
sure.
and instead of taking months to learn a language, they could learn it in a fraction of the time.
I notice as I get older, I'm not losing my focus, because I play a lot of that music, but I have noticed that when I do, I'm able to speed through a lot of legal language and awful lot of legal concepts, and then apply those over to criminology.
The other thing that comes into place that I understand is that if you're learning a language, and it sounds like the type of activity that you do is very verbal, linear types of information, you want to keep your brain balanced, and this is one of the keys for turning on greater intelligence and creativity,
mm-hmm.
is that you need to be aware that you have equivalent amounts of right brain activity
mm-hmm.
to balance out the
sure.
left brain activity.
Oh, yeah.
So the music
yeah,
for you is right brain, and that occupies your right hemisphere, and that leaves your left brain much more free to do its work.
Neil, you know, you're talking about people learning languages through music, and I've noticed that it's much easier, much faster to memorize lyrics to a song, for example, than if you had to memorize that same information for an exam or something like that. Why is it that if we sing words in our mind, we retain them much more quickly?
That may just go back to that, you know, using both hemispheres of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, you know, if you have a car, you've got wheels on the left side and on the right side. Well, your brain is a left hemisphere and your right hemisphere. If you're trying to do any task, it seems to make sense to use both half of your brain.
Sort of like putting it into four-wheel drive, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So when All you're right. memorizing, you memorize verbal information, but you're balancing it with this nonverbal spatial musical type.
All right. All right. And, John, thanks for calling. Good to hear from you.
If I may, I've got one more question.
Sure.
It deals with crime, but very broad. But could you discuss some of the applications for dealing with violent offenders, even victims, looking at stress reduction, even drug addiction and things like that, because meth is now exploding all over the country. And when you were talking about neurotransmitters, I was reading over some research yesterday from someone out on the West Coast who's doing research in that area, dealing with the neurotransmitters and some experimental drugs with people who have meth addictions. But also, looking at what you're discussing, if you could deal, is it possible to deal with offenders? And again, I'm not in a rehabilitation, but I find what you're saying so interesting. And years ago, I told Ross that eventually we're going to wind up getting into the brain and we're going to be getting more people from medical schools into criminology. And we are right now. But is it possible, Dr. Slade, to actually deal with both voluntary and involuntary types of rehabilitation? In other words, people that would come to you with some type of aberrant behavior versus somebody who may be getting some, quote, rehabilitation inside of prisons, which is narrowly.
So one is choosing rehabilitation where the other is pretty much forced into it, is what you're asking,
yeah.
John, right?
Well, okay. I think I understand what you're getting at. Lingo, who was my teacher and who was the director of the Brain Lab, he had a very wide, broad range of people who came up to the laboratory for study and for learning. And a great number of these were victims of traumatic types of experiences as children and as adolescents. We didn't have so much experience with criminals, but my guess, just from what I know about crime, is that many criminals had very difficult childhoods. They were abused as children. They learned aberrant behavior because they were subjected to aberrant behavior themselves. And in effect, their behavior is modeled after their environment and after poor parenting and so on and so forth. Now, of course, that doesn't explain everything, but it explains a good part of that. At the Brain Lab, one of the very key processes that everyone who came to the Brain Lab went through was called self-trauma.
Neil,
yes.
I hate to interrupt, but I forgot to take the break earlier in the half hour.
So after the break.
Doc Lombardi, thank you for your contribution to the program. Good to hear from you. This is Coast to Coast Live on Premier Radio Networks. And you can use those same phone numbers to call the multi-talented Ian Punnett in just about 30 minutes on Coast to Coast AM as Ian is in for Art Bell this evening. His guest, metaphysical author Doreen Virtue, will be talking about the Mer people, the aquatic apes theory, indigo children, and more. We, however, are talking about brain power with Neil Slade, whose website is www.brainradar.com, brainradar.com, and you can order his books, his CDs, his feature film, DVD, and Amazing Brain Adventure by going to that website. Neil, we have a lot of people who have been holding for quite some time, and I apologize to Jerry, who's been on the road holding for the last half an hour or so.
All right,
let's go. Let's check in with Jerry, west of the Rockies. Jerry, where are you calling from?
Actually, I'm in New Jersey. That was the only number I could get down while I was driving, though.
All right. Well, we're glad you did, and I apologize for making you wait so long.
Not a problem. I'm still on the road. I'm a firm believer in synergistic happenings. And I turned on the radio station. I heard you talking about the music and the therapy and the brain. Ironically enough, I just came from a show. A friend of mine, while riding a bike in Philadelphia, guy made a legal turn off a highway and hit her going 50 miles an hour. She was paralyzed from the waist down. All massive amounts of damage. Doctors just brutalized her, butchered her up. After 11 months of getting nothing but pain pills.
Hello?
I think we lost Jerry. I suspect where he was going, if I could extrapolate, and I could be totally wrong, but after 11 months of pain pills, perhaps, I guess, maybe through metaphysical or mind over matter, perhaps she took care of the pain. Now, let's talk about it. I wanted to go there anyway. What about mind over matter? Is there any empirical evidence that it works? Do we have any laboratory critical analysis?
Absolutely. There's a publication that comes out of Arvada, Colorado, close to me. It's a medical journal, and what it does is it specifically talks about cases. We're talking about double-blind studies where it is proven that people have influence through non-physical contact, for example, of healing powers that are transmitted simply by the use of mental imagery. One case study I know of that I'm thinking of in particular is where people were subjected to, let's say, a lesion that was specifically created on someone's arm. And in some cases, they put their arm in a booth and they were told that a person would lay hands over their this lesion and accelerate the healing process. Now, in half the cases, there was no one on the other side of the booth, and in the other half of the cases, there was someone laying on the hands and intending to create faster healing. Well, what the study showed that in those cases where there was the actual laying on of hands and the intention of a healer to speed the healing, those cases had a dramatic increase of speed of healing. And in those instances where there really was no one on the other side, there was no healing. Another case was a double-blind study in which a woman was able to have an effect on the lifespan of bacteria in Petri dishes simply by using her mental faculties and mental imagery. So on a medical level, and since we were just talking about this medical situation, absolutely proven that people can have an influence over healing merely from state of mind. Again, on the medical end of things, we know that laughter and music and creative processes have a distinct effect on increasing the number of natural painkiller chemicals that are produced in the brain.
So it also gets into the positive-negative energy aspect, right?
Yeah.
As well?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, but...
Well, just if, you know, positive thinking, negative thinking can have quite an impact on...
There's plenty of research that shows that that often what you expect to occur, and we see this in quantum mechanics and physics, that the result on an atomic level is very much influenced by what the observer is looking for, and that's on the atomic level. And you can kind of step back and apply that, and the same type of thing most certainly seems to occur on a more gross level of our perception and activity.
All right, Neil, let's go to the wild card line. Hi, Bill, you are on with Neil Slade.
Yes, hi, Ross. How are you this evening?
I am well, sir. How about yourself?
Hi. Very good. Dr. Slade, I have a fascinating idea and concept relating the reptilian brain to what Kim Jong-il of North Korea is doing, scaring the you-know-what out of us in Japan and South Korea by lobbing those missiles, especially the Taepaedong 2 missile, into the sea. And I have a left brain cerebral cortex, logical, rational solution to it that nobody has thought of.
Bill, what's your solution here?
My solution is, suppose the U.S. State Department, through back channels or front channels, through China, was put humans in space like we have, offer a North Korean test pilot who can speak English, to go aboard as a passenger of the U.S. space shuttle sometimes next year if Kim Jong-il promises not to lob any more missiles into the sea.
Well, I think you're on the right, you're on the right line of thought, and you're thinking frontal lobes. You're thinking carrot on a stick instead of, you know, the ruler on the back of the hand. And I think you're making a very powerful and a very smart statement there. And I think history will bear you out that the way to overcome adversity and the way to make peace with the world is not through punishment, but generally through cooperation. And I think you're thinking smart there.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line and another Bill, this one in Lexington, Kentucky. Bill, good evening. Or good morning, depending. I am well. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. I just want to tell you how great of a job you guys are doing, and I have a question for Mr. Slade there.
All right, he can hear you.
Okay, Dr. Slade, my question is concerning the subconscious mind. Is it true, for example, that you can absorb more knowledge, like say you're listening to a tutorial tape or something, is it true that you can absorb more knowledge with the subconscious mind while you're asleep versus the conscious mind while you're awake?
As far as I know, that's kind of a myth. Many years ago, there was a lot of attempts at what is called sleep learning, where you might play a tape with information, but I don't think any of the data really back that up. What is true, however, that the more relaxed that you are, the more easier it is to absorb and retain information. I think at the point where you're so relaxed that you drift off into sleep or unconsciousness, it fails to work at that point. But there's a phenomenon called now I've forgotten the buzzword for it. But educators know for a fact that if children are stressed out, they do not learn anywhere near as fast as children who are enjoying what they are learning. So it's very important and the reason for that is simple. This goes back again to the reptile brain and the frontal lobes. If you're clicked backwards into fear and into fight or flight or any type of stress, that's going to be drawing energy and processes away from the other parts of the advanced brain and primate brain that can most efficiently deal with the utilization of new information. So the more the better you'll learn.
Along those same lines, I know personally I did much better in high school and on into college with the elective courses rather than the ones I was forced to take. I mean, there are some that I liked, but I always did much better. I think most people do better when they're taking a course of study that they enjoy.
Yes.
And, for that very reason.
And whatever it is that you're trying to do, even if it's an unpleasant task, okay, that you may not want to do, if you can inject humor, if you can inject imagination and creativity, you know, the classes that I remember in high school were the ones that we had lots of fun doing, you know, and I'm thinking about physics and biology. Those, I will never forget those high school classes because my teachers really made it into a very enjoyable, stressless activity. So no matter what it is you're trying to do, you know, use your creative brain, use your imagination, and make it fun. And you'll learn faster, and you'll learn better.
All right, let's go back to Jerry, who you may recall was with us a bit ago. We lost the signal. He had a friend who was in a terrible vehicle accident, hit by a car on a bicycle, and in constant pain. And, Jerry, you were just about to tell us that after 11 months of pain medication and
the drama.
Talk about a cliffhanger. What happened?
Well, after 11 months of having nothing but more pain and they offered to give her more medication for the side effects, and she just said, no, enough's enough. She's going to do it on her own, and she was studying about macrobiotic diet. And she went on to a macrobiotic diet, and her pain specialist at the time had no idea what the diet would do. She didn't really know. She said, I'll get back to you in a month, and I'll let you know what's working out, but the pain pills definitely aren't doing anything but making me loopy. So she went on her own, did the diet, came back a month later, pain had decreased by about 30%.
Uh-huh.
And the pain that she was still having, she could control.
Okay.
So just a positive thought, huh?
I was just talking about this with a friend this evening, and we were talking about the effect of a low-carbohydrate, high-protein diet.
So, Neil, is there such a thing as literally hear about brain food? Is that, does it exist?
Oh, yes. There's all kinds of foods that are specifically will energize and are good for brain function, and I can get into that. But
right, and we will get into that when we return here on Coast to Coast Live. Neil Slade is our guest. We're talking the brain on Premier Radio Networks. The power of the brain and how you can click your amygdala forward to move on to a higher plane and use more of your brain. And our guest, Neil Slade. Neil, we were before the break talking about specific brain foods.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, anyway, they found that high protein, low carbohydrate would make you very irritable and would have a distinctive negative effect on your emotions. And food has a tremendous ability to alter emotions and affect the way that your brain functions. Now, often I cite some of the most useful foods to increase good brain function are things like blueberries. Of course, all fruits and vegetables, but blueberries specifically have a very good ratio of chemicals that are good for neurotransmission. The omega-3 oils are good, and those are found in flaxseed, and they're found in fish oil. Those have been found to be very helpful in alleviating depression. People who've been on antidepressive medications, there are many reports that they've been able to drastically reduce that medication, if not get off of it completely through the use of increased omega-3s. So that's a very helpful food for people. And the best thing to do is really, you know, go on the web and search, and you can find something that you'll like the taste of, that it's also good for your brain.
All right, let us go to east of the Rockies. You are on Coast to Coast Live with Neil Slade.
Dr. Slade, I called in, it's been quite some time ago, I never had called in before, and I'd had a seizure. I'm epileptic, I have been all my life, and I had this dream that people were drowning, and they were talking about the brain, and I called George and told him, and about a week later, the tsunami happened. And about 3 weeks ago now, I had a really bad seizure, and I had to be intubated. I was in ICU, and ever since then, I keep having this dream of, I don't know, it looks like a mountain in the ocean, and it's on fire.
Uh-huh. Sounds like an undersea volcano.
Yeah, something like that. But, I mean, and I got this real sense of desperation, you know, like a lot of people are going to get harmed by it or something. Why am I doing this? I hadn't had seizures in 20 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, often what we at one point see as a brain dysfunction, we later learn is a way that a person's brain may be picking up information and signals that a person with so-called normal brain function is not picking up. So you may have some issues that you're more sensitive to things than others. I had, you know, you speak of a volcano. There was the volcanic eruption in Indonesia that happened a couple months ago, and I woke up one morning, and not only did I have the dream of the volcano, but I actually saw a map of Indonesia and the volcano happening in the middle of that map. And I got up and I brushed my teeth and I went to the coffee shop, and that morning I opened up the paper, not having seen it before, not having seen any television broadcast about such a thing or hearing any radio, and sure enough, it was the volcano eruption that had happened in Indonesia that very day that I had somehow perceived while I was sleeping. Now, what that really, you know, makes me think of is that when we are asleep, and especially in dreaming, we may be much more open to information, some global cosmic communication that is blocked by our conscious mind when we are walking around. You know, when we are in bed and sleeping and dreaming, we leave ourselves very vulnerable and open. You know, we're unconscious, so any kind of thing can happen and get through to us. So, you know, your dreams that you're having may very well be indicative of some sort of precognitive or telepathic information that you're getting. And
Neil,
we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Neil, do we all have the ability of ESP, extrasensory perception?
Yes, and that was one of the things that we learned through years of work at the Brain Lab, that everyone has this. And the director actually had it, he called it normal paranormal, because he didn't see it as distinctly different from the normal sensory information that we have. He just saw it as an extension of that. The key to tapping into the so-called paranormal abilities or ultra-normal abilities is to click forward out of that fight or flight, counterattack, reptilian mindset. If we can turn off the fear, okay, if we can turn off the counterattack and that reptilian reactive urge and move the energy and processes forward into our frontal lobes, that's where all the ultra normal and paranormal extensions of awareness happen. So the trick is to overcome the basic fear and fight or flight and reptilian, is to grow beyond that. That's how we turn on those paranormal things.
All right. What about, you know, somebody touched on sleep learning. What about subliminal messages? Or is that an effective way to get a message to someone that they will remember or to influence someone?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of subliminal tapes and CDs and things like that. But in my mind, what is really happening is somewhere you keep, when you put on a subliminal tape, you are in essence telling yourself that by, you know, you're giving yourself the message, this is going to help me learn what I'm trying to learn. And I think it's really the positive reinforcement that you're giving yourself, even more so than the actual physical material that you may be listening to on a subliminal tape or CD, that's really helping. It's the confidence. It's the release of stress. It's it's the positive direction that you're giving yourself by saying, hey, I'm gonna do this activity and it's going to help me in this way. And so this positive message that you're giving yourself, that's what's really taking effect there. That's my opinion.
All right. And on that note, we will bring to conclusion our discussion with Neil Slade on the brain and clicking your amygdala forward. If you'd like to know more about the work Neil is doing, you can please go to his website at www.brainradar.com. You can order his books, his music and audio CDs, and his feature film DVD. Neil, it's been a most enjoyable evening, and we will, I'm sure, hear you again in the not-too-distant future on Coast to Coast.
I had a great time, and I really appreciate what I think was an excellent interview by you this evening, and thank you very much.
Well, you put my brain to the test. Of course, it would be a lot easier to talk about the brain if I had one that was more highly developed. So, Neil, thanks so very much for being with us and my guest on Coast to Coast.